This show proudly sponsored by Real American Freestyle Wrestling.
From high atop Fox News headquarters in New York City, always seeking solutions, never sowing division, it's Brian Kilmeade.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to the latest moments of the show. We have so much going on today to report. We'll try to stay up with all of it. President's still overseas, supposed to be coming back, but things have not stopped. You got the South Korean trade delegation flying into Scotland to catch up to him quick. This hour, we're going to be joined by Lieutenant Colonel Alan West, the Republican Party, Dallas County, the Republican Party chair, as well as Lieutenant Colonel in the Army. Eli Lake is standing by, and of course, we'll have all the breaking news. So let's get to the big three.
Number three.
The 911 call center started receiving multiple 911 calls for an active shooter inside of 345 Park Avenue at 52nd Street in Manhattan. We have five victims shot, our officer, and four other innocent civilians, plus the shooter.
Yep, horrific shooting in New York City. We watched it here yesterday. 345 Park Avenue was the target, home to some of the most powerful companies in the world, including the NFL. Six shots, five dead, including an officer with two young kids and a baby on the way. We follow this investigation.
Number two.
But we're going to be getting some good, strong food. We can save a lot of people. I mean, some of those kids are, that's real starvation stuff. I see it. And you can't fake that.
Although some of it was faked, coming to a head, Hamas refuses to negotiate or give up the hostages in a crisis situation for the people they rule over in Gaza as the world tries to work on the folly, which is a two-state solution, and Trump pushes Bibi to act.
Number one.
I would have thought, and I got to own it, that these tariffs were going to sink this economy by this time, and they didn't.
They didn't, Bill Maher, and you're right. Trump shocking the world, his critics, and perhaps even his allies with massive trade deals that make America stronger. Next up, I think China, India, Mexico, and Canada, if they are smart. But, of course, Gaza has gotten the world's attention. Why? Because that's what Hamas wants. By refusing to legitimately negotiate, by allowing all the higher-ups to be killed and the ones remaining to keep on fighting wherever they're hiding, which are in tunnels. They don't ever go at you directly. There is a lot of food that cannot get into Gaza, and people are no question suffering, but Hamas making it worse, and they're thoroughly responsible. And Donald Trump saying, hey, Israel, step up. Cut 17.
Israel has a lot of responsibility. They're hampered by the fact that you still have 20 hostages or so. And the people of Israel are very concerned about the 20 hostages. It's very interesting. You could say they could be more concerned about retribution than the 20 hostages, but they really want the 20 hostages to survive and live to make it.
Retribution's already happened. It's a matter of these guys getting out or dying or giving up. Eli Lake joins us now, columnist for the Free Press, contributing editor at Commentary. Eli, the president's pressuring Bibi now to act, and they're going to try different ways to get food in there, and these people are suffering. But we should also always remember who's responsible.
Oh, yeah. Well, obviously, Hamas is responsible. They started the war. Hamas is responsible for the civilian casualties because they created an entire military infrastructure honeycombed and underneath the civilian infrastructure of Gaza. And they have hoarded food and sold it at very high prices on the markets. So they are kind of partners with the main UN, known as UNRWA, the United Nations Works and Relief Agency, that was created just to deal with the Palestinian refugees. And Hamas has infiltrated it and basically, for all intents and purposes, taken it over. That said, I think that Israel made a blunder when they announced that they were they're completely shutting off the border after Hamas violated the ceasefire a couple months ago. And this was, I think, a sop to the more right-wing elements of the government, Benazir Smotrich and Itamar Ben-Gvir mainly. And I think that in some ways kind of unfairly led to Israel being blamed, because what they were really doing was coming up with an alternative through this Gaza Humanitarian Foundation, which I think is a good idea. I don't think we know most of the story as to how there have been so many of these incidents where live fire is fired into crowds of people who are coming to get food. But it was a mistake to sort of in a show to sort of say we're going to close the border to all these other things and try to put pressure on Hamas. It's not going to work with a group like Hamas. Dead Palestinians, dead Gazans are the goal of Hamas. That is what they want. They're fighting an information war as well as a real war. So at this point, I don't think that the president is really putting tons of pressure on Netanyahu. I think some people are reading too much into that. But the Israelis are now going to airdrop food. They're going to try to flood Gaza with food. And hopefully we're going to stave off a hunger crisis. It doesn't change the fundamentals, which is, you mentioned it at the top. You got to get those hostages back, but it's not just the hostages. Hamas can no longer be an effective military or political presence in Gaza, full stop. Because if they are, then you're going to get another war. Yep. If they are, Palestinians are going to continue to suffer. So if you are the humanitarian at this point, you have to figure out how do you pressure Hamas. Now, there's one thing that hasn't been tried, and that is either directly targeting Hamas leaders abroad in other countries. I'm mainly thinking of Qatar, but there's some in Turkey, or putting the screws to the Qataris, who I think are kind of like the funders at this point, or the diplomatic, parents of Hamas, or at least they're their advocates, and explain to them that if you don't, kick out the Hamas leaders in Doha, then we're going to start seriously considering taking our military base out of Qatar,
but
so you got to play hardball with the Qataris.
But Eli, we keep hearing that Israel is not upset that the leadership is in Qatar because they know where they are. They have to deal with them at some point. So I don't even think that Netanyahu wants him out of Qatar, because at one point, if they're not going to do a deal with him, I mean, they can assassinate him in Iran. But I think that they, for a long time, the Qataris said that the Israelis were communicating with them there about Hamas. So I'm interested.
I think that's a little disingenuous, because the Qataris have enormous amounts of leverage over Hamas. The idea isn't necessarily to kick them out. That's not like the end goal. The end goal is to put enough pressure on the Hamas leadership that is living in luxury that they will then at least use their influence on the ground in Gaza to get to an end to the conflict. And that is where that's the card that hasn't been played. The Qataris act as if they are intermediaries. They're not intermediaries. The Qataris are in part responsible for Hamas. Now, there was a deal. It was a devil's bargain before October 7th, where Netanyahu allowed the Qataris to fund Hamas because somebody had to fund infrastructure in Gaza.
Right.
And his view was it was better to have them there, being funded by Hamas, and then, potentially having another one of these kind of humanitarian crises. I think the wisdom of that has been exposed. I think that was a foolish kind of short-term thinking. But nonetheless, that's what it was before. But now we have to acknowledge that Hamas and Qatar have this relationship that we haven't allowed ourselves to fully see. Hamas is very much indebted, especially now that they're so much weaker in Gaza, to Qatar. So Qatar needs to put leverage on Hamas or face the consequences in their relationship with the United States. That's how I see it.
So they're looking now, this big push, which is just folly, of a two-state solution. First France and now the Starmer over in the UK. Listen to the UN General Secretary, Cut 24.
Let's tell it straight. For decades, Middle East diplomacy has been far more process than peace. Words, speeches, declarations may not have much meaning to those on the ground. They have seen it before. They have heard it before. We know the central question for Middle East peace is implementation of the two-state solution, where two independent, sovereign, democratic states, Israel and Palestine, live side by side in peace and security.
And that's what they're going to be doing at the UN. What a great idea. Two-state solution. It really went well in 93 with Oslo. Remember, they were going to have the land bridge from Gaza to the West Bank. And look what they did with that. So why are we even thinking about it? You know who doesn't want a two-state solution? Hamas, the Palestinians don't want
obviously
a two-state solution.
Yeah. Well, I mean, yes, everything you just said is correct. The problem is that what you end up doing is if you get a two-state solution now, which won't happen for the reasons you just said, but it looks like a reward for October 7th, and you don't want to, you don't want to create that impression. What you want is you want the, but you know, here we are, the UN has been terrible about this from the beginning when there was evidence that there were UN employees, I think something like 24 who participated on October 7th, many more who supported it in these text threats. That was a scandal that was exposed almost 2 years ago, right after October 7th and the months after it by Hillel Neuer's group, UN Watch. The UN, they went into dissembling mode. They treated it as a political spin kind of thing, and they tried to deny it. They acknowledged what they had to acknowledge. This guy Guterres, I mean, the UN Secretary General has zero
exactly
credibility in my view, and it's just completely wrong. If you want a two-state solution, you have to get behind destroying Hamas, and if you want a two-state solution, frankly, you also have to understand that you're not going to get one with the current geriatric leadership of the Palestinian Authority. You have to, it's a much harder kind of problem than, he's acknowledging at this point. So I'm with you. I think it's a joke. And I would point out the difference in Oslo is that at that point, you at least had Arafat telling Western audiences, if not his own, Palestinians, he has reformed. He was no longer seeking to destroy Israel. He was no longer endorsing terrorism. He was cooperating with the United States, and the CIA played a major role in that in trying to round up the extremist elements. So there was a lot of stuff that Arafat had done to get to that point where we were so optimistic about peace. It obviously didn't end up working after 2000. He couldn't come up with a counteroffer in the final Camp David talks, or for that matter, in the Taba talks after Clinton's presidency. So in that respect, what we have here is, a bunch of wish casting really from the UN, and it's dangerous because if this is seen as the path to peace or path to statehood, then it creates the incentive for more October 7th. It creates the incentive, frankly, for more war. So, it's like the road to hell is paved with good intentions, and if we're granting these are good intentions.
I know, but it's stupid. Dumb. I mean, like France meeting with Mahmoud Abbas, that disgrace criminal who takes the millions of dollars of aid and makes himself a billionaire and sits there in exile in West Bank commanding four people. It's crazy. By the way, Eli Lake, our guest, if you're watching on Zoom, you understand that. But if you're listening on the radio, just see if you recognize the voice. Real quick, you wrote about this, and it's going to become a much bigger story. The whole Russia hoax leading up to 2016. And if you have to really take a second to understand what is new about this. What is new about this is that Hillary Clinton is as dirty as you could be in all this. And it seems like Obama's intelligence team picked up that she was doing it. And the Russians picked up that they're about to be blamed for colluding with Donald Trump erroneously to circumvent an election. Because they did hack her emails. And they did try to do stuff with social media, but they never infiltrated our election, and they certainly didn't do what Hillary Clinton's team said they did.
The Steele dossier, Well, listen, I, as you know, I've been writing about Russiagate for a long time, and I took the slings and arrows from many of my colleagues in the mainstream media when I was really pointing out what a scam and a scandal it was. That said, I do think that the latest documents that were released last week, the declassified version of the House Intelligence Committee report from the end of 2017, early 2018, is valuable because it shows just how much John Brennan, the director of CIA, was in disagreement with his top handpicked analyst to put this intelligence community assessment together. That said, the fundamental thing in that intelligence community assessment, it did not say that Trump colluded with Russia. What it said was that Russia had developed over time a preference for Donald Trump in the election. I think it's fair to point out that there was intelligence that didn't totally support that. But on the other hand, if you look at it, we agree on the facts that the Russians did hack Hillary. and we agree on the fact that they leaked it in the middle of the campaign, well, that did benefit the Trump campaign, unless you want to argue either that the Russians didn't hack, which some have said, but all the documents actually confirm that that was a legitimate conclusion from the intelligence community. Or you want to argue that the release of these embarrassing emails from the campaign, particularly I'm thinking here about the Goldman Sachs speeches that she wanted to keep hidden, or there was a devastating memo that was released about Clinton Inc. and how he had made $30 million since he was left the presidency in these private speaking gigs for like various kind of shady oligarchs and banks and so forth. If you want to argue that didn't damage her, I believe it did damage her. But if you want to say it didn't damage her, then maybe that was the case. But I don't think that it's, I think focusing on whether or not there was intelligence to support what the Kremlin's preference was is a little bit like evading this larger point, which is that if they were leaking and hacking and leaking one candidate in a binary race, then the other candidate was a beneficiary.
But Eli, real quick, we're up against a break.
Yeah.
This is the issue. When you concoct a relationship between Trump and Russia, regardless of the emails, because you don't like that email hack and nobody would. But because you did that and the DNC got exposed, you thought I'll just make up a scandal and I'll let that go right through the Trump first 2.5 years and I'll feed the media these stories. That, I think,
Brian,
is where we're going.
That, we agree, is a scandal. Gotcha. My point is that the new information is not quite that.
Eli Lake, thanks so much. Back in a moment.
It's Brian Kilmeade.
This is Jimmy Fallon, inviting you to join me for Fox Across America, where we'll discuss every single one of the Democrats' dumb ideas. Just kidding. It's only a 3-hour show. Listen live at noon Eastern or get the podcast at foxacrossamerica.com.
From his mouth to your ears, it's Brian Kilmeade.
They seem to be dealing with multiple problems. On the one hand, they're rudderless, as you note. They don't have anything to talk about. And what they do talk about is pretty extreme. It's stuff like transing children or doing lawfare against their political opponents or, you know, engaging in a conspiracy against an incoming administration like they did with the Russiagate collusion hoax. But it's also an effect of what Trump has done in terms of stealing their constituency. So as Trump does have these big economic successes, and as he leans into economic populism, that means that those working class voters that had just been a major contingent of the Democrat Party, they're going to Donald Trump. You also look at what he did with foreign policy, with MAHA. All of these constituencies, the Democrats are losing as they go over to Trump. Now, that doesn't mean that they'll stick with Republicans if Republicans don't stick with those ideas.
I mean, when you look at foreign policy, please tell me where Joe Biden was better. Was he better with China? I don't know. We had pretty productive talks in Stockholm the other day. I'm not sure where we're going, but we are negotiating. And they weren't even talking to Joe Biden's administration for over a year and a half. They begged them. And then when you look at the Middle East right now, we watched October 7th happen under President Biden. Okay. And since that time, more hostages are out. And one way or another, we're going to get to an end there. And anyone who says that Donald Trump is too close to Russia and Vladimir Putin has not been paying attention over the last 2 months, where he has soured on him, said, I give an opportunity, but I'm not going to stick with it anymore. Domestic policy on trade, on growth, please. 9% inflation. If I'm a Democratic leader, I run from Joe Biden's legacy, but I need this thing called new ideas. I'm going to bounce this off Lieutenant Colonel Alan West next.
Fox News Audio presents Unsolved with James Patterson. Every crime tells a story, but some stories are left unfinished.
Somebody knows.
Real cases, real people. Listen and follow now at foxtruecrime.com.
A talk show that's real. This is the Brian Kilmeade Show.
I think that Democrats have been slow to understand the changes in how people get their information, slow to understand some of the cultural changes that have been happening, and maybe most problematic of all, too attached to a status quo that has been failing us for a long time. I think that my party needs to do a better job of addressing the fundamental problems that have led people to mistrust everything.
And that is Mayor Pete trying to grow a beard, change his image, and pretend he wasn't part of the Joe Biden administration. They covered up the fact that the guy was asleep at the switch for at least 3 of the 4 years he was there and did a terrible job as transportation secretary. We should not be surprised because word is he was a terrible mayor. But now he's trying to say we have no new ideas and I'm a tough guy. Lieutenant Colonel Alan West, he's Dallas County's Republican Party chair, American Constitutional Rights Union executive director, joins us now. Colonel, are you buying that Democrats suddenly realized they were trying to hold on to institutions nobody wanted them to hold on to?
No, I'm not buying any of this. And once again, this empty soul searching that you see with a lot of people out there on the Democrat side. You've seen Rahm Emanuel come out there. You've seen the shapeshifter Gavin Newsom trying to, you know, change his image. But the bottom line is that they are completely on the wrong side of all of the issues. And right now, the people that have the loudest and most prominent voices in the Democrat Party are the far leftists, the socialists, the borderline communists, and Marxists like Zohran Mamdani or the guy that's running for office up in Minnesota. They're the ones that are getting the headlines. So I think that what they really need to do is go back to ground zero and try to reestablish themselves and try to have some connection with the American people. They don't have that right now.
So you're talking about the guy who's running for mayor and got the Democratic nomination in Minneapolis.
Yes.
And this guy is a nightmare. He's Omar Fattah. He is, when he calls home, it's Somalia. He refers to Somalia as home. More radical in some areas, more moderate in others. He wants to increase taxing the wealthy, issue legal IDs to undocumented immigrants, banning rubber bullets at protests, supporting single-payer health care, and making Minneapolis a sanctuary for abortion. So let's have abortion and no control over law and order. So it sounds like a great platform to run on.
Yeah, I mean, and once again, he's not talking about the issue of illegal immigration. He's not talking about economic growth. He's not talking about anything that will benefit the people there.
Yeah, legalize illegals.
Legalize illegal and law and order. I mean, we all remember the burning down of the police precinct there not too many years ago. And so here's a guy that is even more left than the mayor that they already have, who was quite left himself. And so this is what the people in America see, and this is why that poll that is out saying that the Democrats are at their lowest of lowest when it comes to their approval rating, their acceptance rate.
So let's talk about what's happening in Russia and Ukraine. The President of the United States is really fed up. He's told us all that Vladimir Putin is just kind of wanted to string him out. And when he says he wants to cease fire, the bombings would actually pick up. And now we know the president's not buying it. Cut 37.
I'm going to make a new deadline of about 10 or 12 days from today. There's no reason in waiting. There's no reason in waiting. It's 50 days. I want to be generous, but we just don't see any progress being made.
Do you?
No, of course not. I wouldn't have given him 10 days. I think that Vladimir Putin has completely shown who he is and what he wants to accomplish, and no amount of negotiations, deals, or whatever are going to change him. I think the most important thing that you can do when it comes to Vladimir Putin is this energy deal that we just saw cut with the European Union. We have got to isolate Russia and their liquefied natural gas exports. And the more we can put economic pressure on Russia to isolate them, just the same as with Iran and China, I think that that's how we turn the tide against this new axis of evil. And Vladimir Putin is not a good man. He's a dictator. He's a despot. His greatest disappointment of the 20th century was the collapse of the Soviet Union. Those are his words.
So far, if people think they're winning, I mean, they are building drones at a dizzying pace. They are using North Korean troops, which should be an embarrassment, and their artillery. But their inflation's over 10%. Their government spending on defense is 60% of their entire budget. Their short-term economy, their short-term approach to the economy is destroying the ruble. Their wealth fund has dropped more from $110 billion to $30 billion. Parts are hard to find because of the sanctions. Computer chips are almost impossible, along with airline material. It is China propping them up with massive amounts of, air quotes, dual-use material. They've lost 600,000. They've had 600,000 deaths and over a million casualties. Why would this guy is afraid to admit it. It's been the biggest disaster in modern times, this move into Ukraine.
He's not going to admit that. I mean, and really and truthfully, if you go back and look throughout history, I mean, going back to even Khrushchev there in Stalingrad, they really care less about their own people. They're willing to sacrifice their own people for the whole purpose of power, control, and dominion. And that is the leftist mindset. It is all about power, control, and dominion. It's just the same as the left here in the United States of America, willing to sacrifice this country over illegal immigration, and they don't care about the scourge that that's causing on the streets of America. So Vladimir Putin wants to stay in control. And this Dmitry Medvedev, I think that he is on some type of psycho drugs or whatever, some of the social media posts he's been putting out there. I think that you can really see a collapse, again, a second collapse of a Soviet Union, but this
I hope
time,
so.
Russia. Yeah, because of this dictatorship.
So listen to what Medvedev posted. Trump's playing the ultimatum game with Russia, 50 days to 10. He should remember two things. One, Russia isn't Israel or even Iran. What does that mean? Number two, each new ultimatum is a threat and a step towards war, not between Russia and Ukraine, but with his own country. Don't go down that Sleepy Joe road.
Yeah, it's delusional. What he is deranged, and again, Russia is not in a position to go and conduct war against anybody else. I mean, they're struggling with what they have done, this conflagration with the Ukraine. And you were absolutely right. If it weren't for China propping them up and North Korean troops being there, I mean, where would Russia be? So, again, if we put stronger economic sanctions against even the Chinese, if we can cut down the trade deficit that we have with China and they're not able to send money over to Russia and they're not able to send these North Korean troops, and China's having economic issues as well. So I think right now the most important thing for President Trump is to keep the American economy strong, and that will force the hand of these other people.
And it is. And the trade deals with Japan and EU have gotten the Japanese public and the European Union upset because they are that strong for us, and we have not had the inflation. We have not had the collapse. The market is at an all-time high. Core inflation is actually down. I think growth is about to explode, let alone what the big, beautiful bill is potentially able to do. Among the people that took notice that the tariff trauma and drama has not taken place is Bill Maher. Cut 10.
Tariffs. Now, I remember I, along with probably most people, were saying at the beginning, by the 4th of July, somebody had a thing how the country was, the economy was going to be tanked by then. And I was kind of like, well, that seems right to me, but that didn't happen. The stock market is at record highs. I don't see a country in a depression at all. I see people out there just living their lives. And I would have thought, and I got to own it, that that these tariffs were going to sink this economy by this time, and they didn't.
He admits it. They didn't. But the thing is, Bill Maher's not an economist. That's okay. You know, it's like, yeah, I'm not a baseball player, but I predicted that the Yankees would run away with the division. All right, I'm not a baseball player, but I watch every day. I got it.
Yeah.
Okay, number two is the economists all got it wrong. Almost all of them got it wrong. You know, Larry Kudlow, whenever, he was saying, listen, he knows exactly what he's doing. I was skeptical in 2017 when I first joined too, but this is going to be a series of reorganizations of our trade relationships, and let's see what happens. But there's no humility amongst these economists, and are they going to come out and say, wow, including the Wall Street Journal, man, I should have given, I know the jury's not in yet, but man, I should have given him somewhat a benefit of the doubt.
Well, I think there's two parts of this. There are some people that wanted him to fail. They didn't want it to be right. They didn't want to give him that chance. And then also they wanted to feel even more so vindicated when that did happen because they wanted to have their relevance. But now Donald Trump has come in and rewritten trade and economic negotiation policy for the United States of America. And it was about time.
Yeah.
I mean, we could not continue on and being abused by these other countries with their trade policies. And now all of a sudden you have $27, $28 billion monthly surpluses, and to the point where now he's talking talking about rebate checks, coming back to the American people. That's how you strengthen an economy, and that's how you take care of the problems and the issues that the American people are suffering under. There's no way the Democrats are going to be able to come back from this because they have nothing to offer the American people by way of solutions.
So the big solution for you, for us and America, will be when you show up in Texas at our big event, August 23rd. Have you made some time for us? Are you going on an important family vacation?
No, I'm going to be right there at the Windsphere Opera House there, downtown Dallas. Looking forward to it. Angela, you know, my wife Angela is a Brooklyn girl, and she lived out on Long Island for a while, so she's looking forward to meeting you as well.
I'm a delight to be around, so I think you should warn her ahead of time. Allison, there's a correct way we should pronounce this Windsphere Opera House, right? I know you gave me this whole thing to read. So why don't you just, let's just get this right. So I know it's in, it's got sponsors, and I want to give everybody the respect they deserve.
It's the AT&T Performing Arts Center, and if we want to say the full name, it's the Margot and Bill Windsphere Opera House of the AT&T Performing Arts Center.
You're going to have to print that out.
I'm going to, yeah.
Okay. Too much.
The AT&T Performing Arts Center.
I'll tell you what, Colonel, I'm worried. There's four tiers to this place. It's the biggest place we ever played at. So,
well, you're gonna be very excited. It's a beautiful facility. I've been in there before, and you're going to knock them dead. And before I go, I got to give a shout-out to Linda up in Wichita Falls. She listens to your show regularly, and she asked me to give her a shout-out today.
I was in Wichita Falls for a big book signing, remember?
Years ago.
That's great. We love those people. And then we drove to Texas right after.
No, because it was in Wichita.
Oklahoma.
No, it was in Wichita Falls where we got our first free lift from our buddy with his private flight, plane.
That is true.
It was Cliff and
Steve Blauer.
No, not Steve. It was the guy prior to Steve. He owns the car dealerships in Wichita Falls. Patterson. Unfortunately, he passed away, but he was the most lovely man.
Oh, that's true. Yeah. He said, I'm worried you're not going to get to your next event in time. I have a plane.
And flew us to Waco.
Yeah, that's right. Colonel, I can't wait. I can't wait to meet Mrs. West, and it's going to be fun.
See you soon, my friend.
Okay.
God bless. And God bless to all the people who lost their loved ones yesterday in Manhattan.
Tragedy just a few blocks away.
Yeah.
Back in a moment.
You're with Brian Kilmeade.
This episode is brought to you by LifeLock. Between two-factor authentication, strong passwords, and a VPN, you try to be in control of how your info is protected. But many other places also have it, and they might not be as careful. That's why LifeLock monitors hundreds of millions of data points a second for threats. If your identity is stolen, they'll fix it, guaranteed, or your money back. Save up to 40% your first year. Visit LifeLock.com/podcast for 40% off. Terms apply.
A radio show like no other. It's Brian Kilmeade.
Our biggest problem is we have so much growth that the Fed won't cut.
What the f***? Jesus.
Oh my God. I'm so sorry.
Hey,
I take it right back.
Everybody,
I take it right
okay.
back.
To your point, Goldman today, the most notable change.
You're fine. Right. You're absolutely
Goldman
fine.
Goldman today, the most notable change.
You want me to say one?
No, I just feel like enough with the the economy's booming.
Let Carl talk now.
Goldman today, most notable change since the June Fed meeting, Jim, is that the data has begun to show clearer signs of below potential growth. Right? And they're looking for three cuts this year.
I don't know why they're looking for three cuts. Honestly, God, the economy's fabulous.
So Jim Cramer, one curse. You know what I mean? Like, I can't believe he overreacted like that, but I guess it's good. I mean, we lost all decorum, but that Jim Cramer on CNBC, I think the bigger story is he was upset with the tariffs. He was as upset as anyone since you're creating the economy for no reason. The economy was going strong. And now he's saying, I can't believe how good this is going, to the point where he used the F word. I had to listen to that twice. I didn't even know what he meant. I was like, is he happy? Because they bleeped it out and there was such panic. I'm sorry. Right?
I mean, his credibility is always like iffy at best.
Who, but Jim Cramer?
Yes.
I know. But he's a big name. And he's a nice guy. Have you met him?
I've never met him. He is a nice guy. Yeah.
Very nice
guy. Good to hear.
He knows he should never have left Fox. He was a contributor on Fox.
Mm-hmm.
He ended up going for his own thing and got in that trouble with Jon Stewart. But what is the economy like now that this Japanese deal is done, now that the EU deal is done? What exactly is the deal, And why are people in the countries that we're dealing with so upset by the result? Why? Because I think these deals went in more in our favor. They got 15% tariffs across the board in both countries, and they got this huge deposit of basically for a sovereign wealth fund in our country from Japan and from the EU. They're going to buy our natural gas to the tune of $750 billion. They're opening up our markets to cars to the point where a French president went nuts and said, who signed off on this? This Benjamin Hajjad, he is the prime minister of France, not the president. He says this: the fight continues, seeking trade balance with the United States. We call for Europe to activate anti-coercion mechanisms in taxing U.S. digital services or exclude them from the public agreement. The current situation is not satisfactory and cannot be sustainable. The free trade that has brought shared prosperity to both sides of the Atlantic since the end of World War II is now rejected by the United States. And he wants the WTO to get on board. In Japan, some blowback from the former president of the Bank of Japan. He said about investments around, he says the America calls this a win-win, but he says it feels as though Japan's sovereignty is being infringed upon. Wow. Just because we're selling them rice? Here's Grant Cardone, cut 14.
Every indicator's up. Jobs are up. Stock market's up. Crypto's up. The Dems are down, okay, but the American people are winning. That's what he promised, and I expect this guy that has the golden touch that most people cannot think this simple is going to change America for the best.
Well, we'll see. Senator Chuck Schumer, of course, he was jumping on the fact that Japan's not happy and says that we're not really giving that much money. It's more of a financing loan, whatever. Here's what he tried to say. Cut six.
Over the weekend, Donald Trump announced a new trade deal with the European Union. It will result in a $90 billion per year tax hike on American families. When you raise tariffs, the American families pay for it. $90 billion tax on American families in this tariff deal with the European Union.
Okay. He is basing that on nothing. All those projections about costs and the retaliation never happened. They are building it into their production costs. I think at some point some companies will, no question. But the question is, with the tariff money, as we pay down our debt, the interest rate goes down, the country has more opportunity and is healthier. I think we've gotten over $120 billion worth of tariff money. We have $28 billion last month. And now it's going to be into our infrastructure. Look for South Korea's flying to Scotland to do a deal, as I mentioned. I think India is not going to let that August 1st deadline slip by. And who knows what's going to happen with Mexico and Canada.
From the Fox News radio studios in Midtown Manhattan, it's the fastest growing radio talk show. Brian Kilmeade.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to the latest moments of the Brian Kilmeade Show. We come to you from 48th and 6th in Midtown Manhattan, heard around the country, around the world. And, of course, everyone's talking about the horrific shooting yesterday on Park Avenue. And we'll get into that. This hour, we're going to be joined. Well, actually, I'm going to be joining the Varney Show. We'll do a simulcast with Stuart Varney on FBN. And Kevin Roberts, Dr. Kevin Roberts, the president of the Heritage Foundation, is here. We have a lot to discuss, the trajectory of the Republican Party, the Trump administration, as the president hangs out in his golf course over in Turnberry, Scotland, and the world comes to see him. I'm not kidding. South Korea's delegation is on their way. So before we get to Kevin, let's get to the big three.
Number three.
The 911 call center started receiving multiple 911 calls for an active shooter inside of 345 Park Avenue at 52nd Street in Manhattan. We have five victims shot, our officer, and four other innocent civilians, plus the shooter.
Horrific shooting in New York City at Park Avenue, home of the NFL. Who was the target? Was it a major financial firm? Or was it the National Football League? Six get shot, five sadly lose their lives, including an officer with two young kids and a baby on the way.
Number two.
But we're going to be getting some good, strong food. We can save a lot of people. I mean, some of those kids are, that's real starvation stuff. I see it. And you can't fake that.
Well, some of it was faked, but there's definitely tough sledding in Gaza coming to a head. Hamas refuses to negotiate or give up the hostages. A crisis situation for the people there that are ruled by Hamas in Gaza. Is there going to be pressure on Bibi? And what about this push for a two-state solution?
Number one.
I would have thought, and I got to own it, that that these tariffs were going to sink this economy by this time, and they didn't.
Trump shocking the world, his critics, and perhaps even his allies with massive trade deals that make America stronger. Next up, China, maybe India, Mexico, and Canada, and South Korea, if they are smart. Kevin Roberts joins us now. Kevin, you guys, great to see you.
Yeah.
You guys crunch the numbers. Now, we don't have a lot of details on Vietnam, Philippines, and the UK, now the EU, Japan, Indonesia. But from what you've seen in the framework, what do your economists tell you?
Our economists, who I think happen to be the best in the country, are really excited about the framework they see. They, of course, are waiting to see a couple of categories of details, Brian, and they're right about that. But the most important thing to say is that the progress we're seeing with these deals, even if all we have is frameworks, each one of them gets a little more detailed. For example, the framework with the EU is really detailed. It's very clear that on that one, the United States is going to benefit, particularly American energy companies. That's going to be really important for geopolitics.
But it works for them too, by the way. We're a reliable supplier.
It really does. And we've been telling, as you know, we've talked about this over the years, we've been telling our European friends who ask Heritage to translate what Donald Trump and J.D. Vance mean, because sometimes Europeans incorrectly assume the president doesn't like Europe. And our answer to them always is, no, the president loves Europe so much, he wants you to pull your own weight. He wants you to pull your own weight economically. He wants you to pull your own weight militarily.
You've said that to them, by the way.
I sure have.
Yeah.
And it's so good to see that happening, to your point, to the benefit of Americans and Europeans. But as we get more details, I think when we get through the next economic quarter or two and our economists are able to see that there isn't runaway inflation as a result of these tariffs, that actually the United States is benefiting from it, we're going to be really celebratory.
And I think that if the other deals don't come in, the president's got a plan, and that came out yesterday too. Cut two.
You said you were going to set essentially a tariff for the rest of the world.
For the world.
What percent will that tariff be?
I would say it'll be somewhere in the 15 to 20% range.
So that's what everyone's going to get, and that's going to push people to do a deal. Don't we hear about this all the time? Whether you're trying to buy a car or trying to buy a house, you're playing cat and mouse, and he says, no, I have a card to play. It's called the American economy. And I said I want to rebalance it. You've met me before. You know I follow through. And I think it all seems to be working out for him. Well, what is your sense on the tariffs and that converting to a tax? Because traditional conservatives were giving the stiff arm to tariffs.
Yeah, and at Heritage, for example, we don't wake up in the morning and say tariffs are the end-all be-all, right? But trusting President Trump's motivation, what we have attempted to do from the outside informally is suggest that they take the reciprocal part of the tariff and convert it to what's called a border adjustment tax, which basically is what the Europeans have, where foreign exporters pay that tax, not the American people. That kind of thing, which we've written about for several years, I think may be where this is going, either formally or informally. The benefit of all that is the bottom line, Brian, the president is using tariffs as a tool to correct the lack of free trade by so many of these countries who then are so arrogant to turn around and tell the American people, oh, you're not actually implementing free trade because you're not in this agreement with us. He's really calling them out. And I think if you give this another 3 to 6 months, it's all going to settle out. I was meeting with some business folks in New York yesterday who, like Heritage, don't love the idea of tariffs, but they love the clarity that's coming from these deals.
Right. And I think that, you know, it's interesting. The first time around, they go, we're going to wait this guy out. Clearly, this is not going to work. He comes in. He's such a rookie when it comes to politics. They don't have that approach now. And you saw UK for the UK Prime Minister yesterday. You must have laughed out loud, as I did. They used a 5-minute press conference. The president sat there. They had a meeting. They said what they had to say. And he sat there for over an hour and 15 minutes. They talked about everything. And you could see Starmer's like, well, our women won the European Union championship. He had like nothing to say after a while. But the president is showing respect for the American people by doing that. He's not really showing it to the press. He's saying, this is what's happening. This is what I'm thinking about. You see him thinking with Vladimir Putin. I thought I could do a deal with this guy. It turns out he was just playing me, and I don't have to wait 50 days. I'm going to wait 10 to 12. You never would have a leader talk that openly and honestly about something that consequential.
He is the most transparent president in American history.
Because that's what he's like one-on-one.
Totally. You know that. I know that from the relationship each of us has with him. And I wish more people would see that. But the interesting thing about his second term, to your point, is that both Americans and people around the world are seeing that side of Trump. He's a very warm, caring person who cares first and foremost, as he should, about the American people. But he wants people around the world to flourish. For example, on the Ukraine-Russia war, you know, you and I both know that the president is very much a pacifist. He hates the notion of innocent lives being lost, as most of us do, obviously. But that's really motivating him to be so frustrated with Putin, whom he thought he had enough of a professional relationship with to be able to settle this conflict. I'm very confident that that 10 to 12 day timeline is real and that we're finally going to see an end to this conflict.
I know. And I think it's very real. The thing is, too, he knows that Russia right now is trying to get as much done as possible, I guess, within the 50 days, or he's going to ignore it. But if you look at some of the facts about their economy, I know they're used to absorbing pain and they're not used to a quality life, but their government defense spending is now at 60%. Now they say about their entire economy, inflation is over 10%. They have a sovereign wealth fund of $110 billion. It's down to $30 billion. They can't get airplane parts. They can't get computer chips. China single-handedly is sustaining them with these so-called dual-use products that they're sending over that they're still using for weapons. At one point, he might be evil, but I didn't think Vladimir Putin was crazy. I thought, as Trump probably did, I'm giving him an off-ramp that actually is face-saving. Why do you think, because I know you could surround this thing 180, why do you think he doesn't want that off-ramp?
I think because he's, from his vantage point, Putin's own politics in Russia, he believes he's past the point of no return. And he had an opportunity to take that off-ramp from our point of view in the first couple weeks of the Trump administration. We were predicting that at Heritage for the very reasons that you mentioned. And the most important thing, other than Trump being elected, that was a change in a positive way toward that was Germans and other European countries cutting off their purchasing of Russian oil and gas, which, by the way, they were doing while they were telling the American taxpayer to support the Ukraine military effort.
Were they doing it through third party or were they doing it direct?
Directly and then third party, but that's now over to their benefit. But to your point, the real thing that keeps this going is China. And so where people need to connect the dots is not just with the conversation Trump's having with Putin and Russia, but how this is connected to a potential China trade deal as well. Trump, bottom line, is resetting the geopolitics of the world for the rest of the century, especially if we're able to bring the end to the Ukraine-Russia conflict.
Did you hear anything that came out of the meeting in Stockholm? Because I have not.
Not yet.
So about China, Mike Pillsbury reporting yesterday that he had sources to say that China was going to mention a path to a ceasefire with Russia in that meeting.
I would not be surprised.
So they are in control of that. I mean, as much as they are in control of the fentanyl precursors.
If you listen to the data you read off about Russia's economy, they are in dire straits. And it's hard for anyone of us in the West to understand internally what's going on there. But our great experts at Heritage believe that they're in dire straits. And I think that probably has something to do with the president's aggressive timeline.
Just from what you could tell, will there be any push to have a massive number of confirmation votes before the Senate leaves?
Man, we're working on it. At Heritage Action in particular, which is our advocacy arm, we're arguing that they should stay in session or actually have a real recess so the president can make recess appointments. But the news from Capitol Hill this morning is not very positive.
It isn't. For example, when I'm wide, as we switch over to Gaza, we're watching the UN now having meetings about a two-state solution. Is there a bigger waste of time than a two-state solution talk? And Mike Waltz, if he had that job, would be able to hold a press conference to say there is nobody that wants a two-state solution. The Israelis have given up on it and the Palestinians don't want it. What are you doing, UK, possibly, and France, saying that demanding it?
Well, it just shows you how out of step these European leaders are, that they're talking about something that no one believes is possible. We certainly don't believe it's a good idea at all. And so that is an utter waste of time. And it really does underscore that if you had Mike Waltz in that position as UN ambassador, that we would benefit from it, the world would. But also think about the EU trade deal. What if we had our Heritage colleague, Andy Puzder, actually confirmed as the ambassador to the European Union? Not only would that be helpful with the messaging of this, the framework of this deal in America, it would be helpful in Europe.
Oh, there's no question. And he'd be really strong at it, too. There are so many people. Also, in talking to Sean Duffy, I said, Sean, it was good that you got in there early. He goes, Brian, I got no staff. I have no deputy, I have no undersecretary. And now he goes over to NASA, same thing. So, I mean, they're really hurting the country. And I'm going to encourage, too, when there's a Democratic president, and there will be, this is not the point. This is not where you should be holding people up. If you are going to vote them yes, and Waltz is getting through, the only people you're hurting is the country.
You can always count on Democrats in the Senate to change tradition. And the tradition in this country is whichever party wins the presidency, they get to appoint their people and get them confirmed, with rare exceptions if the person is a total goofball. And in this case, these are extraordinarily competent men and women who are there to do the work of the American people. Ultimately, this is going to be a huge political loser for the Democrats.
All right. I got to ask you, this is something we were asking up before. We hopped on the air. A former member of Heritage is going to be running against primarying Senator Lindsey Graham, who is now in the president's good graces. They fight, famously. But tell me about this matchup, and who do you support?
Well, look, we don't endorse in primaries, at least up to this point. I will say that our former colleague is an excellent patriot, very conservative, like you and me and your audience.
Paul Danz.
Yes, Senator Graham has shown recently some signs of being conservative. He has the president's endorsement. But I'll just have to say, I don't mean this in a personal way, that Senator Graham exemplifies the Washington swamp. And for us at Heritage, for 50-plus years, as you know, we've tried to break the back of the power of the Washington swamp. So we need a lot of people like Paul Danz running for office.
So with Lindsey Graham, do you think there's ever a time to work with Democrats?
Oh, sure.
Because that's what he's known for.
Particularly when the Democrats want to do something that's conservative, that's a great time to work with them.
Right. So when it comes to foreign policy, do you feel like where do you the rubber hit the road with you and Senator Graham? Like, can you name a couple of policies?
Sure. I think that Senator Graham, I know that Senator Graham is much more willing to be engaged in an endless war without a strategy than we are at Heritage. It's not that I think he's unpatriotic. We just have a difference of opinion. The second thing is he has a tendency to cave on spending bills. And, you know, for us at Heritage, in addition to foreign policy, conservative fiscal policy is very important to us. On those two things, there has been a long pattern of not being conservative. And therefore, on our Heritage Action Scorecard, Senator Graham scores very low.
He does. We'll see what happens if he gets another 6 years. Sooner or later, all these guys going to age out, right?
That's part of it. Around forever. Actuarial reality will catch up with all of us, right?
Right. And I want to – do you have a few more minutes?
Absolutely.
Yeah, I want to talk about what you see happening in Georgia, New Hampshire, some of the other battleground states, and also in Texas, a lot of intrigue in the primary process. You're listening to the Brian Kilmeade Show. Kevin Roberts is here from Heritage. Don't move.
Diving deep into today's top stories, it's Brian Kilmeade. The more you listen, the more you'll know. It's Brian Kilmeade.
We've got some quality time left with Kevin Roberts at the Heritage Foundation. He's the president there. And Kevin, first off, there's some Senate seats that can go either way. For example, where does Heritage stand, or you personally, when it comes to Ken Paxton or Senator Cornyn? What would you like to see happen there?
We would like to see real conservative representation in Texas. And so for me, being genuinely good friends with each man, respecting each, Senator Cornyn clearly not as conservative as General Paxton, I would either like Senator Cornyn to have a more conservative voting record, which I've told him respectfully, or for General Paxton to beat him. Ultimately, what the people of Texas and the American people need more of is Republican senators who are actually really conservative.
I think that the one thing that Texas Republicans have trouble getting over is the gun reform that he voted for, right?
It's a sticking point.
Next, do you believe do you support the president trying to redistrict Texas?
I do.
And even if the ripple effect is they try to redistrict New York and California?
I do. And the reason is that Republicans have been way too bashful over the last 50 years in wielding the authority and the power they have when they happen to be in power. And I was meeting with some Texas legislators a couple of weeks ago, and I asked them, I said, are you concerned? I asked them the same question you just asked me. They said, no, because we need to do what we're going to do, and they're going to get that done. It is a little bit of a crapshoot about whether some of these other states who have threatened to do that will actually make good on it.
So when you talk about some of the other Senate seats that are open, who are you leaning towards Georgia? Or are you in a wait-and-see mode?
We're in wait-and-see mode. At Heritage Action, which is our political arm, we tend not to get involved until the general election. But I can tell you one person I am very excited about is in Kentucky. and that is Nate Morris. In fact, I'll be visiting with Nate Morris soon. He's kind of from the Trump mold, a businessman, very close with the vice president, who's a friend of mine, as you know, and look forward to seeing his candidacy.
Because Mitch McConnell's not running again.
That's right, and that's going to be an upgrade.
Right. Keep in mind, too, they can elect a Democrat in Kentucky.
They can. Right?
They did.
People forget
governor.
That. Yeah. That's right.
So when you look at Scott Brown in New Hampshire, is he your best alternative?
Absolutely.
He's a friend of the show.
So yeah, no, I love Senator Brown. And I think that if he can be back in the Senate, especially representing a purple state on its best day of New Hampshire, that's a real win for the conservative movement. He's also, as you know, Brian, one of the most articulate messengers in our movement. And because of the politics of New England versus the politics of where I'm from in the Deep South, sometimes we will say some different things, but it's out of tremendous respect in the same way that sometimes you and I do the same. We have to be in add and multiply mode in the conservative movement in order to have an enduring coalition.
Mike Whatley in North Carolina, the best alternative?
Absolutely. I love Mike. He did a great job last year. Wonderful RNC chair. Saw him last week, and I just think he's going to be fantastic.
Against Governor Roy Cooper, who Democrats say is a moderate and is going to be strong.
He is a formidable candidate because he succeeds in being dishonest about the fact that he's so liberal.
Right. Okay, fine. That is the most interesting, circuitous route. I'm going to figure that out in like 20 minutes. That's exactly what you meant. It's going to catch up to me.
Sometimes the academic comes out.
Right.
I'm sorry.
And lastly, this is where we're going to differ. I think with the border sealed, the president, with the border sealed, should consider some type of extended work visas for the people here over 10 years.
I think
citizenship.
Yeah, I think the devil's in the details. Heritage is very happy to have that conversation now that we have the southern border secured. We'll be really happy once we get all the felons removed.
Kevin Roberts, thanks so much. Heritage.
If you're interested in it, Brian's talking about it. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
Over the weekend, Donald Trump announced a new trade deal with the European Union. It will result in a $90 billion per year tax hike on American families. When you raise tariffs, the American families pay for it. $90 billion tax on American families in this tariff deal with the European Union.
Where does he come up with that money? Where does he come up with that figure? And so far, the problem is this is in April. In April, he says that if you people, and by the way, Republicans were saying it too, tariffs and taxes, and they said this is going to be X amount of dollars. If it was April, and I would say, and I think I did say, we'll see, right? Because he had his Liberation Day, we'll see. But now we're coming to the end of July, and core inflation is down. Overall inflation slightly up, but down. I mean, not increasing with, you know, my goodness, Joe Biden at 9%. Even though interest rates are not down, the economy is going to grow. And they say it's going to grow from 1.7. Now it's going to go at least to 2%. And we had $28 billion worth of additional revenue come into our coffers last month. So now over $100 billion are in. And he still says it's going to cost all of us. I mean, I saw some people say it's going to cost families $1,800. And my answer to you is, because this is uncharted territory, and these economists have almost all been wrong, by the way. When are they going to do that? So Grant Cardone, he's the Cardone Capital founder. You've seen him on our channel a lot. And he said, he heard what we heard. Cut 13.
But look, the numbers don't lie. I mean, the Dems said the tariffs would kill us. The comedian said it. The talking head said it. The economists and the bankers, they were all wrong. But the numbers are the numbers. We have budget surplus, first one since 2015, of $28 billion. That's just real money. We have manufacturing jobs coming back. We have Donald Trump going to the Middle East and Japan and across the world, bringing in $5 trillion of new business. He used the tariffs to negotiate that. He's generated billions of dollars of new federal funds for the American people and our country without taxing the people.
That's what's happened because the other countries say, look, I'm not into rocking the American economy, getting on the wrong side of Trump. I want to do the best deal possible. So they've been eating it. Now, I know the car companies. We happen to know a clothing manufacturer said, I have to find out what's going on in Vietnam and China. Because my whole product line is made there. And I said, well, can you potentially do it here? He goes, we're not good at it. And he said, by the time I ramped up a another manufacturer to get my quality, my business would fall apart. And they built the business and got the financing off Vietnam. So now Vietnam was the first trade, the second trade deal done. So he's got some certainty there. And I think it's, you know, it's important to point out that when Chuck Schumer, who's been told to act tough and wants to shut down the government, because last time that he did a deal not to shut down the government, he almost lost his job, has to go out and say these trade deals are terrible. Do you notice there's not a lot of people saying that? Because they're not, and they haven't been. So now you have South Korea coming to do a deal. You have India, I am sure, has got to do a deal. It makes total sense. There's no tension between the nations. There's just disagreement, which means they're going to take it right to the deadline, try to get the best deal possible, because we have a lot of trade with India. It's to our benefit. And what happened yesterday in China, I'm not with China in Stockholm. I am not sure. But the word is they want a durable agreement by August 12th. Now, the reason why I think that China actually might fulfill whatever they promise, and we'll see, is that Trump's going to be here for 3.5 more years. Last time they weren't convinced with the Russia stuff and the impeachment things, and then, of course, the pandemic. We're not going to worry about phase two of a trade deal. This guy's not going to get reelected, and I'm going to have to start fresh anyway, and the new Democrats going to come in, and they're going to lift the tariffs that Trump put on aluminum and steel. And the new guy came in, and the new guy left all the tariffs on there because they thought they were actually effective, but he never enforced phase one of the trade deal about buying all this stuff from our farmers. Lastly, when we saw what happened yesterday with the Midtown shooting, just horrendous. This 27-year-old Las Vegas resident who evidently played football, we think, in high school. He had a note in his pocket that talked about CTE. He wants a brain examined. Went with a rifle. You see him walking down the street. You've probably seen the footage before. He goes in, walks to the right at 345 Park Avenue, sees a cop, kills the cop instantly, sees two women cowering, in one man and one woman cowering in the corner, shot him point blank, reportedly. Sees him, goes into the elevator, gets in the wrong elevator bank, gets out, sees a woman walk out, lets her walk out, thankfully, and then went up to the 44th or 43rd floor and shot one other person and then shot himself. He did shoot a member of the NFL executive committee. That person is surviving right now, fingers crossed. But think about this. Why did he double park a BMW, had money? Why did he go to 345 Park Avenue? He absolutely knew where exactly he was going to go. Number two, he understood weaponry. He had his, they say that people that know guns and rifles say the way he held it, the composure in which he showed, he had a bulletproof vest on, reportedly, and he left a handgun in the car and medication. Don't know what the medication is, but that's going to tell a story. Word is they've already gone heavily through all his stuff in Las Vegas. Here's Mayor Eric Adams, Cut 32.
5 innocent people shot tonight. We lost 4 souls to another senseless act of gun violence, including a member of the New York City Police Department, Officer Islam. He served in the 47th precinct. He was just 36 years old and a 3.5-year veteran of the department. He was doing what he does best, and all members of the police department carry out. He was saving lives.
So here you go. You have an officer, 36 years old, from Bangladesh. He had 2 boys at home, another one on the way. I'm sure Tunnel to Towers is going to step in. They always do. Thankfully, that's a little bit of a bright side. But there's going to be a huge funeral in New York City and a ton of questions. It does look like maybe he was targeting the NFL, because everybody knows the NFL's in there. But so are the most, from BlackRock on down, some of the most lucrative corporations in the country are also located in the same building. Here is Jessica Tisch on the officer, Cut 30.
He's assigned to the 47 precinct in the Bronx. He was doing the job that we asked him to do. He put himself in harm's way. He made the ultimate sacrifice. Shot in cold blood, wearing a uniform that stood for the promise that he made to this city. He died as he lived, a hero. I want to extend my profound sympathies to all of the victims and their families, and to the brave NYPD cops who today lost a brother. There are still many questions that we have to answer, and we will answer them.
So here's what the shooter was. This is how she described the shooter, Cut 28.
The shooter is believed to be Shane Tamora, a 27-year-old male with a Las Vegas address. The vehicle he exited is registered in Nevada to Mr. Tamora. Inside of that vehicle, officers found a rifle case with rounds, a loaded revolver, ammunition and magazines, a backpack, and medication prescribed to Mr. Tamora.
That medication is going to tell a big story. Russ in Virginia. Hey, Russ.
Yes, good morning, Brian. I hope you're doing well.
All good. What's on your mind? I know you... you're calling about something different. You're talking about the Russia-Putin thing, Russia-Putin and Ukraine.
Yeah, I hate to shift gears. It's an interesting topic, but before I start, I'd like to tell you that Michael Goodwin is the best on-air personality in radio or television, period.
He does a great job.
He's terrific. He's very insightful.
Okay.
You know, years ago, Brian, I heard a talking head. It could have been on TV or it might have been on the radio, but he said something I never forgot. And it was about Soviet or Russian expansionism and how, you know, we have a mindset in America that casualties are bad and
yes.
They exact a big toll on politicians when it starts to pile up. In the Soviet Union or Russia, if you will, they don't have that concern. Human life is just fodder for their expansionist.
But they are human beings with families. At one point, they stood up in Afghanistan and they demanded a change of policy. It doesn't seem like they have the power to do that now because they've lost 600,000 minimum and over a million blown off the battlefield with some type of physical or mental wound. Thanks so much, Russ. I appreciate the call. When we come back, I'm going to do Varney and Company. We'll have a simulcast. We're going to talk more about this shooter and then take your calls at the bottom on the other side. Also, President of the United States, is he going to cut a deal with another country before he leaves his golf course in Scotland? Man, if that's his vacation, I hate to see his work days. You listen to the Brian Kilmeade Show. So glad you're here.
Listen to the all-new Brett Baer podcast featuring Common Ground, in-depth talks with lawmakers from opposite sides of the aisle, along with all your Brett Baer favorites like his all-star panel and much more. Available now at foxnewspodcasts.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
Now, the Brian Kilmeade Show joins Fox Business's Varney & Company with Stuart Varney, live on your radio and on Fox Business. Here's Brian Kilmeade.
All right, that was a heck of an introduction. I'm going to be with Stuart Varney in a matter of moments. And then at the back end, I'm going to be able to take your calls, 1-866-408-7669. The President of the United States just commented on the shooting over in New York City yesterday at 6:45 p.m. Eastern Time. And of course, the president knows that well. I think his tower on Park Avenue, I think his is on Lexington or Fifth. His is on Fifth. So the Trump Tower is on Fifth Avenue around 55. So think about 10 blocks away. So if it could happen on 345 Park Avenue, a lot of times
51, that's kill me time. Brian, I want to talk about the shooting in Midtown. A gunman opened fire in the building, killing four people, including an off-duty NYPD officer and a senior Blackstone executive. He took his own life. This has rattled executive suites across the country. We don't want corporate executives being targeted, but that's maybe what it looks like.
It does. We still have to find out what the 27-year-old mental, who has got mental issues. He had medication on him, clearly had some degree of training because of the composure that he had and the equipment that he carried. But he knew we wanted that building. And it could be some of the biggest, most successful investment firms in the country, or it could have been the National Football League, because that's evidently what is pocket litter showed, a goodbye letter, a suicide note that says, basically, study my brain. I have CTE because of football. But why is he mad at the NFL? He never played in the NFL. I mean, that just shows a deranged character. But we'll see where this plays out.
Look, the New York City mayoral candidate, Zohan Mamdani, he spoke about the shooting right after it happened, and he said this: I'm heartbroken to learn of the horrific shooting in Midtown. I'm holding the victims, their families, and the NYPD officer, who, by the way, has subsequently died. By the way, but Mamdani did say he's grateful for all of our first responders on the ground. Brian, this is the same guy who had called for defunding the police. He's called the department, quote, racist, anti-queer, and a major threat to public safety. You know, what confidence do we have if he becomes the mayor of this city to keep us all safe?
None. And we shouldn't have any confidence. He's saying to you, if you elect me, you think it was bad when de Blasio, the world's worst mayor, took $1 billion out? And by the way, set up a Thrive firm that his wife ran for a charity. All the money's gone, and we're talking over $1 billion there. You thought it was bad when he took the homeless unit and said we're going to disband it, the terror unit, no longer fund it. You think that's bad? That's nothing compared to this guy. Because at least de Blasio didn't run on that. He did something diabolical. He changed midstream. But we got spoiled with Bloomberg. We got spoiled with Giuliani. And I thought the New York City residents would understand how picking the wrong guy or woman would be a disaster for their life and for the city. But so far, if you look at the Democratic primary, they have not wised up. Also, first responders. He wants to put social workers in that column. Right. Can you imagine a social worker showing up at Park Avenue yesterday?
Well, look, I'm getting a lot of pushback, but I think Mamdani wins. He's got the youth vote, he's got the progressive vote, and he's got the entire Muslim vote. At this point, I don't say who can beat him. I think he's going to win. What say you?
Well, Mayor Eric Adams says for him to win, he's got to get Cuomo out. So he's been aiming at Cuomo. He hasn't even started yet. Sliwa says if all four of them stay in, I have a pathway through. My hope is the New York Jewish community understands you'd be electing an anti-Semite that wants to arrest Benjamin Netanyahu and really has nothing good to say about Jews in America. And you could just get that. You also understand, too, that any capitalist that might be a Democrat will go, this guy does not like our philosophy as a country. Can you imagine him being in New York as we celebrate year 250? He'll probably go to Uganda for another wedding. Who knows? I think it would be a disaster, but no one should criticize you, Stewart, because he is the favorite right now. So, I mean, not saying you want him to win. You're just saying you think he's going to win.
It's just such a shame. I was recently in London and Paris, and I flew back to New York, and New York just doesn't compare. There's so much wrong with New York, which I don't see getting fixed in the near future. It's a real shame. What's happened to our great city, Brian?
Well, I'm not a fan of London either. It became London Stand. They let all these illegal immigrants come in and take over. They're not trying to become Brits. They're trying to become Pakistanis in Britain. And who knows, Somalis in Britain. And I just think that they're destroying the culture in England. And the president had a great message over there. Guys, control who's coming in your country. Yep. I don't care how unpopular it is. It's for the good of your nation. I'm not saying immigrants are bad, but you have to decide who comes in.
Yeah, the president made a big point of that this morning. Hey, Brian, I'm out of time, but thanks for joining us. We will see you again real soon.
I understand. Yeah, 1-866-408-7669. Quick note. Allison, you got to get it out again so I do the right read. But coming up on August 23rd and then September 27th, Richmond, Virginia, I want everybody to join me in Richmond. It's going to be great September 27th. And, of course, everyone's going to be back to school. But at this time, we're still in the middle of the summer. Coming up on the 23rd, where am I going to be, Allison?
You're going to be at the Margot and Bill Winspear Opera House of the AT&T Performing Arts Center in Dallas, Texas.
And that's all.
That's all. You can simply say the AT&T Performing Arts Center.
Oh, you think I can get away with that?
No, that's allowed. But if you're going to say the Opera House, you need to say that whole thing.
Just know it's a beautiful venue.
Yes, and you should
It goes up four tiers. That's a lot of Texans.
That's a lot of Texans when you still probably won't wear your cowboy boots.
Of course not, because I'm not a Texan. But I did write Sam Houston, the Alamo Avengers. I don't know if that means anything to you. Go to BrianKilmeade.com. You get tickets. It's going to be streamed on Fox Nation. There's also going to be specials. The streaming service is getting better every day and more exciting every day. In fact, I'm doing something on Hulk Hogan. I'm taping his biography that's going to be on Fox Nation probably by the end of the week. So I'm taping that today for Fox Nation. But if you go, you can get as many as 6 months free. So, and it's really a great deal. So that's something to keep in mind. Just go to BrianKilmeade.com for that. We are following all the major stories that are taking place too today. We're also keep in mind too that if you ever miss the show and can't hear it live, like everybody's listening to it now, you can always grab the podcast wherever you prefer your podcast platform to be, or you go to BrianKilmeade.com and it'll just lead you there. Brian Kilmeade Show. Don't move.
It is time to take the quiz.
It's five questions in less than 5 minutes. We ask people on the streets of New York City to play along. Let's see how you do.
Take the quiz every day at thequiz.fox. Then come back here to see how you did.
Thank you for taking the quiz.
From high atop Fox News headquarters in New York City, always seeking solutions, never sowing division, it's Brian Kilmeade.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to the latest moments of the Brian Kilmeade Show at 48th and 6th in Midtown Manhattan, just blocks away from the shooting took place yesterday that had America and I guess around the world people transfixed. With me now is Paul Morrow, Fox News contributor, attorney, retired NYPD inspector, has pretty much been working for 20 straight hours on this very on the shooting. We're also going to be talking about these Trump shocking the world with these new trade deals, as well as everything coming to a head in Gaza. But, Paul, first things first, what How has this story developed? A 27-year-old shooter, we know about that. We know we lost a 36-year-old police officer with two kids, one on the way. We also know we have four other people who lost their lives and one is struggling to keep it. What else can you tell us about the motive and the shooter?
Right. So those of us who were talking about this last night were focusing on the motive just for the purposes of ensuring that there wasn't somebody else out there, right? That's why in a case like this, you care about motive so much, because you want to see, is he part of a group? Does he have an accomplice? Is he following a website? Has somebody weaponized him? It's coming together, it looks like, as a pretty narrow narrative, at least as far as we know right now. He works in a casino in Vegas. He's a licensed gun holder. He's had a couple, at least two, mental health incidents that police are aware of. He gets in his car. He goes to New York, looks like direct. Doesn't even look like he stopped. Two prescription drugs in the car and a bag of weed.
30 hours?
Looks that way. Now, you know, he may have stopped off for a little bit, taking a cat nap. He stops for coffee, something like that. That I don't know. But drugs in the car, as I mentioned, two of them, at least prescription drugs, looks like a bag of weed. Comes in through New Jersey, appears to go right to the location at Park Avenue, double parks, goes in, does what he does. The notes that are subsequently found in the car, along with another gun, the notes seem to indicate the following. He had CTE, or at least believed he did. He blamed CTE, chronic traumatic encephalography, encephalopathy, excuse me. Tough word to say. And he blames that, and he blames it. His having it on the NFL, despite having never played in the NFL. He says that he watched a documentary and that sort of triggered him, apparently, in him, this idea that the NFL covered up the effects of ECT and that they were to blame and they did it for money. And so he wanted to make a statement. Then he offers his brain. He says, study my brain regarding ECT.
No, he didn't play college football, right?
You know, I do not see any indication he played college. If he did, it wasn't much of a career. But he definitely did not play at professional level. He didn't play in the NFL.
Mind you, Mangione, where he didn't even have a problem with that healthcare company.
Yeah.
Or that CEO.
Yeah.
But he wanted to just thought that he was going to be a martyr and do the right thing by assassinating somebody in the street.
Yeah.
Do you think on some level in this twisted mind he thought he was doing the right thing?
Yeah, I mean, it does seem
He wanted to get a football. He wanted the NFL.
Yeah, it looks like he went, the NFL is in that building, not that floor.
Fifth
now, there
floor.
Were some administrative offices on that floor, and he may have somehow or other gotten some information that he thought that was like the brain trust up there or something. But otherwise, it looks like, and according to the mayor of New York's press conference, he went to the right building, the wrong floor. But the NFL has a number of facilities around town. But for whatever reason, he chose that one. He goes in the building. And then, you know, we know the rest.
Here's what Mayor Eric Adams said about the officer that lost his life. Cut 32.
Five innocent people shot tonight. We lost four souls to another senseless act of gun violence, including a member of the New York City Police Department, Officer Islam. He served in the 47th precinct. He was just 36 years old and a 3.5-year veteran of the department. He was doing what he does best, and all members of the police department carry out. He was saving lives.
So 3.5 years on, and what happens, could you explain this? I did not know this, that it's through the NYPD. Sometimes these businesses want additional security.
Right.
So I always thought it would be something you guys did on the side, but he was wearing a full uniform,
right,
and he's getting paid on salary?
Yeah, that's a good question. So what happened, this is something the police department did intelligently a number of years ago. Cops used to work off-duty, as you say, sometimes off the books and stuff like that. And what would happen is, because they're licensed to carry the gun, they would be working, let's say, in front of a restaurant, a bar, things like that, doing security, sometimes executive protection for somebody. And if they have to take police action, they would say, well, I'm still a cop off duty. That's what you expect out of us, which is true. And I had to take police action to safeguard life and limb. And they would expect the police department to indemnify them relative to that. Police department's position was, well, you were not working for the police department at the time, and that was off-duty employment. Our indemnification of you doesn't extend that far. Yeah. So what the police department did, as I said, quite intelligently in my mind, is they put together this thing called a paid detail. And it's a program where people who want a uniformed cop who's working off-duty to go through the police department, you gain all the protections of being an NYPD officer, but it is essentially off-duty work. And what it does is, as you mentioned, it allows you to do it in uniform, which has that strong deterrent factor. And that's what Officer Islam was doing.
So, yeah, he's in full uniform, making some extra money, right. Got a third kid coming on the way. So we'll see what happens. What does that tell you how bad it could have been? Because I believe the NFL is on the fifth floor.
Yeah.
And it is like a bullpen area in some of those areas. Mm. So do you think that from what you could tell, even though he was deranged, he seemed composed?
Yeah.
So he got to the 44th floor? Was it 44? Okay.
There's a little squishy. It's a little,
some people say 34.
Is a little squishy. I'm pretty sure it's 33rd.
But as somebody who must not have been thinking clear, I don't know, but fifth floor and 44th, big, or 34th, huge difference.
Sure.
So you plan that much. You plan, you get there, but you don't know what floor you're going to?
Yeah, I mean, there are a number of sort of contraindications embedded in this thing. Like, for instance, he gets in, he immediately starts to shoot, right? He shoots the cop, he sprays the room, he's shooting at a woman who ducks behind a pillar, proceeds to the elevator, that's where he shoots the security guard, okay? Now, he's waiting for he calls the elevator. The elevator door is open, there's a woman on the elevator. She walks right past him, he doesn't do anything. Nobody knows why. But that's what happened. He gets in the elevator. Who knows if he just hit a button on the elevator, he got on there, he didn't realize it was an automatic elevator like a lot of buildings have these
days. Like we have.
Exactly. And it took him to 33. He got off on 33. That's where he shoots somebody else. And then, again, another strange aspect of this entire thing, he has a handgun in the car, but he doesn't bring the handgun in. He decides to commit suicide now with a long gun. Now, that's a big, long gun. To shoot yourself in the chest with that is difficult. So I don't know if that was planned or what, but he manages to shoot himself in the chest and suicide using a long gun as opposed to a handgun that he left in the car.
Because they say in the letter, study my brain. And if you shoot yourself in the head like most guys do in those situations, you can't do that.
That's right. If he blows his head off, I'm sorry to be so graphic, then it's not going to be much to look at.
So how far away is the NYPD from up to capacity? I mean, we had up to 40,000 troops, cops, and now I hear the number's 34,000, and we can't even fill up an academy class.
Yeah, it actually looks lower. I think the number I was hearing last night is 31, and that sounds closer to accurate because they, you know, how they report these things, they can be a little cute with. But look, I can tell you, I live in Manhattan, and when I came on, I was part of the very omnipresent forward deployment of NYPD. The thinking was put these guys out there in uniform, walking around on the street, foot posts, you're on your feet for 8 hours. It's, you know, it can be tough, all kinds of weather, but it doesn't matter. That's the job you took, and people see it, and it's very strong deterrent. The best way to solve crime is for it to never happen, and you had cops all over the place. And that was in all kinds of neighborhoods, but also in the heavy New York City central area of Midtown. I walk around now, I never see a foot post.
I don't either. Yeah,
you just don't see them.
What do you mean foot post? Like
a cop walking on foot. Yeah, just by himself, middle of the night. I used to be out there 6 to 2 a.m. and sometimes later, 6 to 6, walking around in Times Square, and you know, back when it was a little crazier, and you know, that's just what you did, and you know, you didn't think anything of it because we had 40,000 cops. The precinct that this occurred in has gone down from putting out like 12 cars at shift down to like something like three.
Unbelievable. Yeah. Is it because their standards are high? People just don't want to sign up. They're not paying
as
well.
Dropped it. They dropped the standards. Nobody wants to be a cop. Listen, nobody takes the cop for the takes a cop job for the money. In fact, the money is actually not that bad when you roll into benefits. It's not great, but you can work off duty because you have the gun. You can do security work. If you're a hustler, you take some overtime. You know, you're going to break $100,000.
And you're going to retire in 20 years.
You can retire. Now it's up a little bit, 22 and a half, but it's still a good, good deal. And you get a lot of opportunity. And if you can take the tests and really apply yourself, you can make decent money and do pretty well and have a heck of a career. The difference is these days, the morale is so bad because they know they're a target, and so that's why nobody takes it.
So when we come back, do we have another
yeah, sure.
I want to talk about what's happened with the Russia investigation, but not Russia-Ukraine, the Russian hoax part of this investigation. I'm reading some of this, talking to some of the FBI guys, and they're astounded about the level of corruption and really Hillary Clinton's role. Don't move.
This is the Brian Kilmeade Show.
From the Fox News Podcasts Network.
Hey there, it's me, Kennedy. Make sure to check out my podcast, Kennedy Saves the World. It is 5 days a week, every week. Download and listen at foxnewspodcast.com or wherever you listen to your favorite podcast.
Radio that makes you think. This is the Brian Kilmeade Show.
The allegations and the conspiracy theories by Tulsi Gabbard would be sad if they weren't so dangerous. She has turned herself into basically a weapon of mass distraction, is what I've been calling it, because it's very clear what's happening here. She's trying to curry favor and get back into favor with Donald Trump and has concocted these theories to do so.
So is that true, that what Jason Crow, the Democratic congressman, said? Tulsi Gabbard's trying to get back in President Trump's good graces. A guy's done a lot of the investigation on this, too. Paul Morrow, who just broke down the shooter situation at 345 Park Avenue, is now going to tap into you, Paul, for your knowledge of what's new. So Jason Crow's trying to marginalize, as President Obama, through his spokesperson, what's new. So what is new that the American public should know about that Tulsi Gabbard released?
All right. This is one of those things where you almost don't know where to start. Crow's point is that, look, you had a chance to investigate it the first time around and you didn't get there.
Well, you did get there, but you did, and you said the Russians meddled in the election, but they didn't mess with votes.
And they didn't go as far as proclaimed originally. But here's the thing. New information has come to light. Why? Because, in the original administration, that is Trump 45. He was on the defensive the entire time because they were coming at him with crossfire hurricane.
They were going to arrest his son-in-law.
Exactly. So, you know, all the stuff that went on, we don't have to recount that history. But here's what happens now. You get this time around, Trump's older and wiser. He has loyalists around him. They get in there. He's prepared this time. Let's remember something else. Nobody expected Donald Trump to win. And that's why they did everything that they did, the opposition, because they all thought Comey, Brennan, Obama, all of these characters, Kevin Kleinsmith, McCabe, Strzok, Page, Broussard, all of them expected Hillary to win. It was received wisdom. So they weren't worried about ever being found out. Then he wins. They had an old blank moment, and they realized we better stay on this narrative because we're in too deep. And that was realistically the theme of Donald Trump's first administration. This administration, he comes in, he's prepared. And they get in there, and essentially they find a cache of stuff that had not been previously disclosed. And my understanding is it's just archival stuff that didn't go into the normal reporting stream. And these things are very proscribed. The 302s are the workhorse documents. They go into particular databases. They found a bunch of stuff that didn't go through it. It looks like it is prosaic and down to earth as simply they didn't shred everything.
But they wanted to. So Durham was handed, like John Ratcliffe was DNI.
Yeah.
And he asked Durham, this annex, this addition to the Durham report, why didn't you put it in? He said, I want to preserve his investigation, but was going to release an interim report. Then he said he was afraid he'd be accused of politicizing, and it disappeared. So yeah. Ratcliffe comes back, a CIA, said, I'm opening this up. Now, the FBI is finding stuff, too.
Yeah, well, that's what I was talking about, is the FBI. Yeah, the Radcliffe is finding the stuff relative to what you just spoke about. The FBI is finding this whole other trench of documents, and then there's this. And this is the thing that I can't believe doesn't get more reporting. You and I were talking about 2016, the Bureau came into possession of 8 thumb drives that had information relative to Hillary Clinton and what the Russians had collected on Hillary Clinton. Now, where did that come from? The unsecured server, the unencrypted server that she had in a Denver bathroom. Remember, she's Secretary of State. She's going into Russia. Never mind here they could get it easily because it's unencrypted. She's going into Russia as the Secretary of State with an unsecured BlackBerry. They must have been saying to themselves, this must be a false flag. Nobody could be this
stupid. Yeah.
So as soon as she hits send, they have everything, probably before. So they have now, the FBI at this point in 2016, they come into possession of 8 thumb drives. Almost certainly it's that stuff. And that's the stuff that's now coming to light, where we see the Russians were essentially saying, don't blame us. We weren't doing this. And they have the evidence of Hillary Clinton
right.
going forward. And the FBI never ripped into those thumb drives.
Tell me if I'm right. The Russians found out that Hillary, because of these reasons, unsecured server, was going to set them up and say that he colluded with Donald Trump because they didn't want Hillary to win.
Right.
What they're finding in reality is they thought Hillary was going to win.
We all did.
Right?
Yeah.
So they thought he was going to win, and they said we could deal with her, and they did come up with a tranquilizer. She was on tranquilizers, right. and she wasn't balanced, and she right. does. She clearly has physical problems, but not nearly as bad as the Russians laid out to be. So when you're in Helsinki, Paul, and we're talking about Paul Morrow, and you say that Vladimir Putin says to President Trump, who knows he's under investigation on colluding with Vladimir Putin, and he didn't. And he said, yeah. This was her plan. We picked it up
yeah.
when she was a candidate.
Yeah.
We said there, and she might have told him already, goes, and she was said, we're going to set up the Russians to get you. Now, the Russians, as bad as they are, and look at what they've done now. They're killers.
Yeah.
They go, really? You got to set us up?
Right.
So I didn't do it. Mm. And Trump goes, I believe you.
Yeah.
Because I'm watching them make up a story on me right now in real time.
Yeah. And it obviously it got legs. And it became everything that it became in the first Trump administration, which had his administration working with its hand tied behind its back. And now it's coming to light through all of this stuff coming out that it was this entire crew who were in on it. And here's where I go to for the real clear piece of malfeasance that you can demonstrate, yes. that you can begin to build out potentially a prosecution, even if nobody goes to jail, but at least how we can get into discovery and find out what went on, because they're going to fight this tooth and nail. Remember something. The attorney from the FBI, he's an FBI attorney, Kevin Kleinsmith, he admitted to changing the document mm-hmm. from the FBI that said that Carter Page was not a Russian spy, but was in fact yeah. coming to the CIA to say the Russians are poking at me to be a spy for them. He gives it up to the CIA. Does the right thing, patriotic thing. He changed it so that that guy, that Carter Page, would be a Russian spy. And that's how they got the FISA that gave them entree into the Trump administration's, Trump campaign's communications and all their plans. They decided cognizantly, because there's no way
right.
that document that he changed, that has to get reviewed. He was a line-level attorney. So, it goes up the chain.
Having said that, did they go after Flynn? Did they go after Manafort? Did they go after Papadopoulos, knowing that they had nothing to do with this?
In light of the fact that Kleinsmith, and that's why I go back to that, because it's the clearest indication of malfeasance. He got prosecuted.
Yeah.
Lost his license. Of course, he got it back.
They're just trying to create havoc in the Trump term.
It's just they looked at that. They built out from that. They must have, in my estimation, they must have been listening to Carter Page's FISA, which is a wiretap. And they were listening. They're hearing Manafort. They're hearing Flynn. They're hearing Papadopoulos. And they're saying to themselves, meanwhile, Papadopoulos' thing was even thinner. It was based on an Australian source that didn't exist.
It was unbelievable.
The whole thing, like I said at the time, this was either the biggest amateur hour. I wasn't in media at the time. I was working yeah. Intel. But in looking at it, I said, these guys have got to be idiots or it's purposeful.
And that's where we're going to get to the bottom of. Paul Morrow, thank you.
Hey, I'm Trey Gowdy, host of the Trey Gowdy Podcast. I hope you will join me every Tuesday and Thursday as we navigate life together and hopefully find ourselves a little bit better on the other side.
Listen and follow now at foxnewspodcast.com.
breaking news, unique opinions. Hear it all on The Brian Kilmeade Show.
There's what we call ultra-processed. It's the bars you buy that look like health bars. You turn it over, and it's got 35 ingredients. How do you really describe that group of foods that we know are designed for high shelf life? We know they're loaded with chemicals. And how do we encourage people to eat more wholesome foods and natural foods and things with fiber and complex carbohydrates instead of simple carbohydrates? So that's the task. That's the charge. And so we're going to do our best to try to.
So that is Dr. Marty McCary. He's running things over at HHS along with RFK. And, you know, doing some great work as Dr. Oz, and they're a pretty formidable team. They're trying to change things at the most foundational way. With us right now is Nina Tyschultz. She's an investigative science journalist, New York Times bestselling author of The Big Fat Surprise, Why Butter, Meat, and Cheese Belong in a Healthy Diet. Nina, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
First off, how do you feel as though the whole MAHA movement is doing 6 months in?
Yeah, I think there's just been a tremendous political pole shift, like a magnetic pole shift on food and nutrition, the same way that we've seen in trade unions, corporate greed, where you've seen the right really replace the left. I mean, the left in nutrition and health, the left used to be the party of whole foods, back to nature, real foods. That whole space now has been occupied by the right, you know, and I grew up in Berkeley, California, so no one knows this better than me. This is where this is the epicenter of the whole foods movement. And I've been looking for 20 years when working in this field for the Democratic Party to step up and talk about obesity, the problem of chronic disease in children. I saw the Biden White House conference on hunger, nutrition and health go by without a single panel on children's health. They are backed into a corner now because really the MAHA movement has stitched together folks on the right and the left to really create, you know, people understand that the nation is sicker and fatter and we really need to do a U-turn and make things better.
You know, it's interesting. So it's easy to say, so, you know, you're overweight because you're not active enough or, you know, and you're eating bad. But then when you think you're eating good and you don't know why you can't lose the weight, and then we find out the food that we were told is good for us isn't. That, I think, is the subtle difference. It's easy to take a lazy person who doesn't want to do anything or is unmotivated and say you got to get yourself in shape. But what if you thought you were eating good, judging by the guidelines you were given?
Yeah, I can't tell you how many people think they're eating clean and are unable to drop an ounce. And it's really offensive, I think, to the average American to be told, like, it's your fault. You need to exercise more beyond what you're already doing, and you're also, like, trying to work two jobs. And you need to eat better somehow, but you think you're eating well. And the reality is that our dietary guidelines, that food pyramid that we were all sold with the big bottom slab of all grains and starches, and we were told that was the way to eat to be healthy. It turns out none of that is evidence-based. It's not based. It's not. So we were really fed this misinformation, a lie about what it takes to be healthier and lose weight. And that, I think, will change under this administration finally. I mean,
here's what Dr. Marty McCary said about the food pyramid, cut 44.
You can eat all the bad food you want. You're going to have, you know, cupcakes and ding-dongs
America,
or whatever
you're
you
free
like.
To,
you're free. Yeah, you're welcome.
You're free to do bad things
you're
to free, your
you're
body.
You're welcome. You can do it. You can do it. But when we are using taxpayer dollars, we got to make better decisions and not decisions based on the old misinformation of the food pyramid.
So the food pyramid is going to be a thing of the past. When are we going to get a new, when are we going to get new guidelines on everything that we do know about food, which you should be eating, whether you're rich or poor?
Yeah, I hear sometime this fall we will get a new food pyramid, new dietary guidelines, drastically reduced from the 450-page guidelines that are inscrutable to consumers and people don't understand them and include things like water is a nutrient-dense food. So we think we're going to get down to better science, and these will come out this fall. And I think it'll be the most transformative policy change that this administration makes for restoring health to Americans, right? Because this is what affects school lunches, food in the military, hospital food, downloaded to all.
So once you, when they release these guidelines, then everyone's got to change, right? School lunches and military lunches.
It is required by law that all federal programs follow the dietary guidelines. That is everything. So, and the guidelines are considered the gold standard by all health professionals. So they're downloaded and given to patients. So even if you think, oh, I'm not following the guidelines and I would never go to the government for my health advice, you are getting it through your doctor's office or through your health clinic or wherever. They come to everybody. And all of that will change.
And maybe if the perception is we can trust these guys and they put the time in and they can show it to you, then there wouldn't even be much pushback on what the government is recommending, even though they got burned by the pyramid.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's going to be pushback on anything that Kennedy does. But again, let's just get back to the point that, like, what is the opposition, the left, complaining about when they no longer stand for the party of good health and clean food? They had their opportunity to stand up for that. Now, I mean, just this week, there's an article with a Harvard professor quoted defending ultra-processed fake meat, which has the ingredient list of dog food. I mean, that is the corner into which they have been backed based on their ideologies.
Right. That's what I was getting at, is that you only do that if you want to get rid of beef because you believe that cows are destroying the planet.
Right. I mean, that
is. So you make up your own meat.
Right. And pretend that that is better for health than, I mean, again, like the ingredient list of that is, you know, 1,000 ingredients versus beef, one ingredient, beef. Right? Probably the most maligned and healthiest food on the planet. But that ideology that cows are driving global warming has really taken nutrition scientists who are not environmental scientists and taken them completely off the path of nutrition and health. How do I feed myself to be healthy? Instead, we're told you need to feed yourself for what we believe will be healthy for the planet. And if you get obesity and diabetes, well, we're no longer worried about that.
Yeah, the impossible burger is impossible to digest. The FDA will attempt to define an ultra-processed foods, according to Dr. Marty Makary. In layman's terms, how do I know if my food is processed?
Yeah, I mean, ultra-processed is really ultra-confusing. And this is why Marty Makary is doing such a good thing by trying to bring some clarity to this very murky, ambiguous definition. And let's understand that anytime something is ambiguous, that is open season for corporations or people with political ideologies to come in and manipulate the agenda or define it in the terms that they care about. I think two things for your listeners to really understand what this means, why it's so hard to define ultra-processed foods. Like, one of the definitions is it just has too long a list of ingredients. Well, Triscuits reformulated their product, and now they only have three ingredients, like grain, salt, and something else. And they're no longer an ultra-processed food. Do we really think that, you know, box full of starch is good for health? No, I don't. And then another second example. If you make a batch of home-baked chocolate chip cookies, that's not ultra-processed food. Do we really think that's healthy to get all that sugar and white flour and, you know, eat a whole bunch of those? So there are problems with this definition, and I think they're really open to manipulation, and that's why this is such an important effort.
So what did the pyramid have wrong?
Well, let me just give you three examples of what's wrong with the pyramid. Still, 6 servings of grains a day, including 3 servings of refined grains, 5.5 teaspoons of seed oils, right? That's basically soybean oil in the United States, which oxidize and drive inflammation. And then they don't have enough protein. They have, like, amount of protein that is defined as the amount that prevent, like, starving children in Africa from not being able to do anything. But we need to probably double the amount of protein that is recommended for optimal health. We should be going for optimal health, not just, like, fight off starvation.
Well, that would be good. So do you think that what do you say to people who go, well, there's no Whole Foods that'll be in working class areas? Because Whole Foods, if you want to have the fresh food, it's going to cost more. And in your working class areas, you're going to price people out, even though they want to eat well. But if you go to Whole Foods, they're marginally more expensive than traditional supermarkets.
Yeah. I mean, I think that relates to this definition of ultra-processed food and why it needs to be cleaned up. Because currently on the ultra-processed food list, a can of baked beans is ultra-processed. You know, Campbell's chicken soup is ultra-processed. So I think there's, like, an equity issue here. Like, if you don't have time to cook, you need to be able to pick up something that we would currently call ultra-processed food and not feel bad about it and not feel like that's unhealthy for your children. That is, you know, we can't be telling people that you need to go home and cook your own homemade chicken soup. I think that's, like, that's a little elitist of us to be telling people that.
So
we really need to have a definition of ultra-processed food that includes all Americans that we all can work with. I mean, not everybody has time to cook from scratch.
So the one thing I hear is the food dyes are coming out. Every day I seem to be listing another major company is going to take the food out, the dyes out. So I was listening to one of these podcasts, a New York Times podcast, and they said, well, yeah, it's good to get the dyes out. But just so you know, sales will drop because people want to see the magenta in Trix or with whatever green thing in these cereals. How do you feel about that?
You know, am I sad that Fruit Loops is no longer going to have such, you know, robust sales? No, I'm perfectly happy about that. I mean, all of those products, like, do I need electric green ice cream? Do I really need, you know, neon pink fruit roll-ups? No, I don't. None of us do. So
you don't need fruit roll-ups.
I don't need fruit roll-ups. I mean, you know, dried fruit spikes your sugar more in many cases than a candy bar. You don't need those foods. There's nothing about those foods that are healthy. So if they become bland looking and less appealing and fewer consumers buy them, that is a win for health.
So what can you expect? Finally, what can you expect over the next couple of years? We think we're going to get a new food pyramid. We know the RFK is approaching vaccines, which is a whole different thing. What else, if he's being effective and fulfilling his promise, what else can we expect?
I really hope that they do something around the advice that is given through the medical community that is – so it's helpful for prevention and treatment and reversal of diseases, right? So currently, like type 2 diabetes, they're told to eat a high-carbohydrate diet and just cover it – I'm using that in quotes – cover it with insulin. That means huge amounts of insulin. And your disease progresses. It still gets worse. Wouldn't it be great to tell people to simply – eat a low carbohydrate diet or a ketogenic diet, which has proven and shown to reverse type 2 diabetes in 10 weeks, you can get this done. That kind of advice, which would actually be evidence-based, really reverse chronic disease in America. That's something that I know the administration is considering, and I think it would really do a lot to make a change.
Yeah, I do think that they also want to do something on vaccines and putting them through the other tests, and we'll see where that goes. The MAHA movement is safe. The people on the inside happy with the people on the outside and vice versa?
Yeah. I mean, you know, it's complicated and there's a lot of different factions
on the outside. And then you got Callie and Casey Means on the inside now working with. And I'm just wondering if they once they got inside government, are they seeing they're able to move that iceberg?
Well, I mean, you see the amazing amount of change that has happened already. And it's just it's remarkable. Again, we haven't been talking about chronic disease epidemics. We haven't been talking about children's health. That's our future generation. There's just been – it's just been week after week of headlines on this issue, and Kennedy is traveling all over the country and working with states and governors. I mean, I don't know another issue in the administration where, you know, we see such amazing progress.
I know. It's amazing the transformation taking place. Nina, Ty Schultz, thanks so much for coming in. Pick up a book, The Big Fat Surprise, Why Butter, Meat, and Cheese Belong in a Healthy Diet. Nina, thank you for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
Back in a moment.
Increasing your intelligence quotient.
What the hell did you just say?
It's Brian Kilmeade.
It's Will Tang Country. Watch it live at noon Eastern Monday through Thursday at foxnews.com or on the Fox News YouTube channel. And don't miss the show. Listen and follow the podcast 5 days a week at foxnewspodcasts.com or wherever you download your favorite podcasts. The fastest 3 hours in radio. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
Sponsored by Prevagen. Prevagen, made for your brain.
It's funny how the news works. Bill Clinton, you know, wrote a letter to, you know, Jeffrey Epstein as well for his birthday, but nobody's talking about that. Mm-hmm. And Jeffrey Epstein had a picture of Bill Clinton in a dress in high heels, you know, in his New York mansion, but nobody's talking about that. My thing is this. I don't care who's on the list. Everybody got to go. Mm-hmm. Burn it all down. Yeah. Like, that's just simple as that. Mutually assured destruction. Whoever's on that list need to go. Nobody needs to be protecting pedophiles. I don't care what party they are.
No, period. And, you know, to that point, though, you know, Clinton is not the president right now. You know, if he was, you'd think that, anyways, yeah, I think he would still be under scrutiny if he was the president right now.
No, he wouldn't, because liberal media wouldn't push the issue.
Oh, okay.
That is Charlemagne the God, probably speaking practically. Remember, I know the New York Times was the one that broke the story about Monica Lewinsky, that and the Drudge Report, but things have certainly changed. I don't see that ever being the case again, especially when you got to search long and hard to see any positive headlines ever. I mean, it's not possible to be in office for now 4.5 years and not have any positive headlines. I'm literally, it's down to probably 3%. And say you're reporting honestly. I saw this one headline in the New York Times today on Trump because his trade deals are so overwhelmingly positive, right? So I'm looking like, are they going to write that? And they got the stuff about the gunman. I got it. And that should be the number one story. But here's the one headline I found. It's probably the fifth story. It says, Trump is winning his trade war. What will it mean for the economy? All right. A little bit. They said that it might not be all good for the economy. So that was one of the first positives. And that's why I don't think people are going to go out of their way to say anything positive about Trump. Unless, of course, it's a conservative columnist in a liberal newspaper where I have Mark Thiessen, for example. In the Washington Post. But anytime you pick up the Washington Post these days, it is outside that horrible situation with the shooting on Park Avenue. You have nothing but Epstein. Give me an example. We texted nearly 1,100 Americans about the Epstein files. Here's what they had to say. Maxwell urges Supreme Court to hear her appeal. And they go on. And meanwhile, out of the editorials, I guess one or two of the main editorials are about the Epstein files. To me, it's something of interest. They could have handled it better. But since that time, they're almost totally transparent. And when guys like Dick Durbin and others, Jamie Raskin, come out and say, we got to get to the bottom of this, you know they don't care about getting to the bottom of this. They just don't want to hear Donald Trump talk about his trade deals. They don't want to hear him flip on Russia and say, hey, you know what? Russia is the problem. They love saying that he was an apologist for Putin, but Wazuz is a realist for Putin. And I love what Bill Maher had to say about tariffs, the most controversial thing the president has done so far. Cut 10.
Tariffs. Now, I remember I, along with probably most people, were saying at the beginning, oh, you know, by the 4th of July, somebody had to think how the country was, the economy was going to be tanked by then. And I was kind of like, well, that seems right to me, but that didn't happen. The stock market is at record highs. I don't see a country in a depression at all. I see people out there just living their lives. And I would have thought, and I got to own it, that that these tariffs were going to sink this economy by this time. And they didn't.
No, they didn't. And here's Annie Linsky of the Wall Street Journal. Now, nobody was more critical then I think the Wall Street Journal about the president's theory on tariffs. Cut 16.
I think what the markets are, I think, internalizing is this idea that the Liberation Day announcements of the tariffs and the sort of very large and unexpected reciprocal tariffs in many cases was the high water mark. And there's been an ability for most countries to negotiate down from there. And the other piece, too, is that the deals that Trump has made, particularly the recent one with the EU, does create stability and predictability to some extent. And that's something that the, you know, global businesses really are seeking and we're really concerned about on Liberation Day.
And now Liberation Day has got some deals. They used to say 90 deals in 90 days. What happened? You only have one. But now they got a lot more. And people are scrambling to get things done. And they seem to be balancing in our direction. We'll see if overall we can start whittling away at this deficit. Listen to the Brian Kilmeade Show. I'm so glad you are. Don't forget, Fox and Friends tomorrow.
It is time to take the quiz.
It's five questions in less than 5 minutes. We ask people on the streets of New York City to play along. Let's see how you do.
Take the quiz every day at thequiz.fox. Then come back here to see how you did.
Thank you for taking the quiz.